Deutsche Welle Africa Link.
And welcome to Africa Link. I'm Mark Caldwell in Bonn. Coming up, Nigeria's military seek to reassure the population over the fate of the missing schoolgirls.
The good news for the girls is that we know where they are, but we cannot tell you. Okay, we cannot come and tell you military secrets here. Just leave us alone. We are working. We will get the girls back.
And in Malawi, votes in last week's election are being recounted, but voters are still perplexed by the confusion.
If they know they won, why not let the recount take its course?
I also wonder as to why others are clinging to power, yet they have lost ground.
Those stories and more ahead on this edition of Africa Link.
Top story.
Is there a glimmer of hope for the more than 200 Nigerian schoolgirls abducted by members of the Islamist militant sect Boko Haram about 6 weeks ago in northeastern Nigeria? According to Nigeria's most senior military officer, Air Chief Marshal Alex Bade, the military has information about where the girls are being held, but will not use force to rescue them in order not to endanger their lives. But Sam Olukoya reports, in a country where authorities are notorious for issuing false statements, it's hard to know what to believe.
The search for the abducted schoolgirls enters a seventh week as Nigeria observes Children's Day. The day is traditionally celebrated with funfairs, including colourful march past by school children. The event this year is low-key, as activities marking it have been overshadowed with a campaign to secure the freedom of the more than 200 schoolgirls abducted by the Islamist sect Boko Haram. Child rights activist Modupe Debi Ariyo of the Africa Foundation says this year's Children's Day celebration does not call for celebration.
And so it just puts quite a bitter taste in the mouth when you look at Children's Day, and what it signifies is that we're not able to protect our own children, 200 children at least, being abducted. And up to today, we don't even know where they are. It leaves a very bitter taste in the mouth. So there's nothing really to celebrate in that sense.
But Nigeria's Chief of Defence Staff, Air Chief Marshal Alex Bade, told a crowd of Nigerians calling for the release of the abducted girls that there is a glimmer of hope.
The good news for the girls is that we know where they are, but we cannot tell you. Okay, we cannot come and tell you military secrets here. Just leave us alone. We are working. We will get the girls back.
But there are doubts in the minds of many as to whether or not the Chief of Defence Staff has given a true account of the whereabouts of the girls. The doubt seems natural for a military that has made conflicting statements about the missing girls, including a claim that the girls have been rescued. Betty Abba is the Executive Director of the Centre for Children's Health, Education, Orientation and Protection in Nigeria, known as Sea Hope.
We don't know what to believe anymore, especially from the security forces, because we've had so many statements, and then they on themselves have had to recount it. The first time they said they had rescued the girls, when it became overwhelmingly evident that the girls had not been rescued, they had to recount it and say that was a lie. So by the time we've had one or two of such instances, it's very, very hard to rely on the security authorities.
The absence of a credible information about the abducted girls is known to have further increased the agony of their parents.
Sam Olukoya in Lagos. United States aircraft have been involved in the search for the missing girls, but interestingly, the US State Department has said it was unable to confirm that they had been found. Liz Donnelly is the assistant head of the Africa programme at Chatham House in the UK and is currently in Nigeria. I asked her how credible was the claim that the girls have been found.
It is quite possible that they haven't been located. In fact, many people here in Nigeria actually believe that their whereabouts has always been known. But given the support that has been provided, the technical logistical support, it is quite possible that some of the girls have been located. It is impossible to know whether all of the girls will be located at this stage for two reasons. First of all, that we still don't have a confirmed accurate number in terms of the number abducted. And secondly, because at this stage, it is quite likely that have been separated off. But it is reasonable to believe that the whereabouts of some is known.
What options does Nigeria have if it is to secure their release?
The government is in a difficult position here. Operationally, in terms of implementing any kind of offensive there to try and rescue these girls, it would be near impossible, I think, to rescue them all safely at the same time because of the sheer number, because of the territory. So plan B to that would have to be negotiations. But even today, there's different messaging happening about negotiations, whether they have taken place or are taking place. And you're seeing very different kinds of information coming out. The reality is that some kind of a deal is the best way forward for the safe release of as many girls as possible. It would be a very difficult rescue operation indeed. But of course, the problem is that with any kind of deal that is made, it will have longer-term costs.
So how likely is an exchange in which the girls would be swapped for members of Boko Haram who are now in prison?
That is something that has been on the table. It has been reported that a deal was almost made and then the government pulled out at the last minute. The government denies this. But Boko Haram certainly understands that it has this leverage now and it has this collateral. And so it is in a position to negotiate some kind of exchange, perhaps for its own female members of its group. So at this stage, it seems that that might be the way forward, but it is impossible to know how long that could take.
What can you tell us about the pressure that President Goodluck Jonathan is under to get this crisis resolved?
There is mounting local pressure here. This is certainly supported by the social media campaign. Certainly, the international focus on these abductions has put the government under more scrutiny on the Boko Haram issue than it has ever been. And this is making the government very uncomfortable. The difficulty is, in terms of the scrutiny, everybody knows how complex this crisis is and how complex the environment in Nigeria is. There is a sense of perhaps a move towards shifting accountability already on the management of this crisis. So, but it certainly has pushed the government to action, and pronouncements such as the one today about knowing the whereabouts of the girls is in part about recognizing that, that the government needs to demonstrate that it is taking concrete steps. So you're seeing pressure forcing messaging and a shift in action in that way.
Liz Donnelly from Chatham House.
Africa Link, bringing you the story behind the story.
Malawi's confused election continues to preoccupy the country's courts. On Tuesday, it was announced that the opposition Democratic Progressive Party is seeking to bring charges for contempt against the chair of the Electoral Commission and his fellow commissioners. They allege that they did not abide by an earlier High Court ruling rejecting a recount of the votes. That recount is now proceeding. But as George Mahango reports from Blantyre, the news that it will be completed in 30 days is failing to reassure worried Malawians.
In the streets of Blantyre and Lilongwe, many Malawians are concerned about the delay in forming the next government. They are worried that their nation's economy, which depends entirely on agriculture, could be affected by delays in procuring farm inputs. This could lead to low productivity and increase the possibility of a hunger crisis. Some of them complained that they were already starting to suffer from low income due to uncertainty surrounding the hotly contested elections.
What this means is that government and private operations will one day come to a halt because there will be some decisions that require the president and the minister to vet.
As a mother of three, what we see here is that some forces are not willing to accept the loss during the polls, and gain others trying to confuse the Electoral Commission. Why one would refuse the vote recount raises eyebrows. If they know they won, why not let the recount take its course?
We have to understand that some politicians are very happy with the current political situation in the country because they are cashing on it. I also wonder as to why others are clinging to power yet they have lost ground. I pray that as Malawians, we will one day know the truth.
For Ephraim Nyondo, a political commentator and historian, there is need for MEC to be transparent and ensure security of the ballot boxes scheduled for a recount.
The Malawi Electoral Commission should try to be as transparent as they can be in the vote recount so that all the irregularities that we rectified before are addressed. Otherwise, I have a strong feeling that the Malawi Electoral Commission, if left without any external encroachment, has the capacity to do that.
Apart from Peter Mutharika's Democratic Progressive Party, DPP, most of the other political parties have agreed in principle to take a second audit of the votes cast. Malawi's High Court on Monday ruled in favor of MEC, saying they should be allowed to work independently. Peter Mutharika had earlier sought to have MEC release the results of the presidential election within 8 days. It remains to be seen whether legal battles will not continue against the recount despite the court order. But one thing is for sure, government business is likely to suffer come June 31 if there will be no parliament to discuss the budget.
George Mahango in Blantyre.
Africa on the move.
And this week in Africa on the Move, we report on Africans who have literally been moving. Over the past 20 years, thousands of Nigerians have emigrated to Japan in search of work. Now, many say they want to go back to Nigeria, both to enjoy the comforts at home and to benefit from the growing opportunities in what is now Africa's largest economy. Damon van der Linde has the story from Tokyo.
Stickers Karaoke Bar in Tokyo is one of more than 100,000 karaoke bars in Japan. But this one is different. The owner isn't Japanese, but Nigerian. Thompson Imariagbai comes from Edo State in Nigeria.
Yeah, I came to Japan hoping to make a better living here. Yeah, work and maybe make some investments back home.
He first started working at a bar 5 years ago with a friend from his hometown. Last year, he opened his own.
I came to Japan with focus, with plan. I studied what I should do for as a beginner. The first investment I should make in Japan, then I launched a bar.
The next day, Imariagbai is back at the bar, cleaning up and getting ready for another night.
It's normal. It's normal. So we all know Nigerians know how it is. So just work. Yeah, just work.
Imariagbai is married to a Japanese woman called Tomoko. His Japanese wife and her family have been a great help in his business. But to get used to the Japanese culture has been a big challenge for him.
Yeah, all my life, I've been with people that are open, people that you can tell from their expression what they really, you know, people that smiles, talk. I mean, when they're angry, they talk, you know. But going to Japan, their own ways is quite different from... So initially, I look at it as strange, but I've been living there for a long time now, and I find it's normal. You know, that's how they live.
Nigeria has grown to the largest economy in Africa, while in Asia, Japan is steadily losing ground to China, and now entrepreneurs like Imariagbai are looking homeward.
You know, so it's working out the way I planned it. So I just hope to move on the next step. That is. Invest in Nigeria.
Imariagbai is just one among thousands of Nigerians living in Japan. Most of them are found in the Tokyo area. Tony Ikotunya came to do business in Japan more than 15 years ago, exporting used cars and other manufactured goods back to Nigeria.
It's growing day by day. Yeah, it's very big business in Nigeria. So a lot of things is coming up, new things, and there is a lot of demand.
Just like other Nigerians in other countries, Nigerians in Japan tend to cling to their own country people. They've even formed a union called the Anambra State Union in Japan that brings members of the Nigerian community together and promotes Nigerian culture. Ikotunya is the chairman. Recently, the union raised about $70,000 to pay for one of its members to have a kidney transplant.
We are into helping each other, you know, we come from very far place, so we gather ourselves here to help in times of need, like somebody having problem, immigration problem, somebody we lost anybody, we devote to take the person home.
But because Ikotunya is actually a chief back in Nigeria, he says he won't live in Japan forever.
As a chief, you don't stay in the foreign land for long because people need your help. There's a kind of regard you have to people, how to talk to people, making peace. I mean, it's a kind of work too.
And after a long working day, many Nigerians like to indulge themselves in Nigerian food. At Vero Chris African Foundation's restaurant in a suburb of Tokyo, Ngozi Aritz is serving up a Nigerian specialty, egusi soup and pounded yam.
Yeah, I make Nigerian food for our guys, you know. Like Nigerians, most of them don't like Japanese food. So they like coming to African restaurant to eat.
And as Nigeria's economy grows, restaurants like this one could play a growing role in bridging the gap between the two countries.
Damon van der Linde reporting from Tokyo. Sierra Leone has confirmed its first death from the Ebola virus and says it is restricting travel in some areas to stop the deadly hemorrhagic fever sweeping West Africa from claiming yet more lives. More than 170 people are reported to have died of the disease during this current outbreak, most of whom lived in Guinea. Tariq Jasarevich is a spokesman for the World Health Organization, and I asked him if these latest deaths were a sign that the disease was spreading more quickly.
I would not say that the disease is spreading quickly. This just means that not all measures have been put in place to control the outbreak. And we know Ebola virus, we know how it is being transmitted. It's not being transmitted faster or slower than before. It's just that as long as we do not break transmission chain between infected people, we may still see the cases. And this is what's happening right now.
What are the government of Sierra Leone and the World Health Organization doing to stop the disease from spreading?
We have been working with the government of Sierra Leone, as we have been working with governments of Guinea, Liberia and other neighboring countries, to either respond to current outbreak or to put in place preventive measures. And this is what has been going on in Sierra Leone in the past couple of months, because we were afraid that this could have happened. And therefore, some things have been put in place. What is going right now is that there is an Ebola task force that is being put in place by the Ministry of Health, discussing the current situation and trying to propose preventive measures to be implemented. WHO, MSF and Ministry of Health are preparing to deploy field, to deploy to the field a team that would look into epidemiological side but also into response side to this new situation.
What advice would you give to people listening to us in Sierra Leone who are worried that they may have contracted the disease?
Well, what we are basically saying to people is that it's very important to know the disease. It's very important to know how it is being transmitted. Ebola is being transmitted to a direct and close contact with body fluids of infected person. So if you know someone, if you see someone who presents symptoms of fever, vomiting, diarrhea, do not approach this person, call nearest health facility. But it's also important for people to know that any person who is healthy is not dangerous, so there is no problem in touch people. The only thing is really to avoid contact with the visibly sick people and avoid to touch bodies of deceased people who had Ebola. The most important thing is really to watch out for the advice issued by the Ministry of Health and other partners.
Tariq Jasarevich from the World Health Organization.
Making a difference.
In South Africa, more than 5,000 workers in the sugar industry downed tools to demand higher wages on Tuesday, bringing production to a standstill. The stoppage has hit sugar milling and refining facilities. But it's not all strife in South Africa's sugar industry, at least at community level. For this week's Making a Difference, we visit a sugarcane farming cooperative and hear how it is helping to stem rural decline. Subri Govender reports.
Mansomini, a farming community 70 kilometers north of the city of Durban, farmers are loading newly harvested sugarcane onto a tractor. The sugarcane belongs to a group of 75 families who began farming in 2011 with the aid of South Africa's Sugarcane Growers Association and the government. Mansomini used to be a village inhabited by groups of subsistence farmers. Today, the village has turned itself into an agricultural cooperative that grows sugarcane on a 165-hectare farmland. The person behind the initiative is 33-year-old former actuarial science student Siobonga Madlala. Madlala was forced to cut short his studies in order to provide for his family. Together with Mansomini village elders, Siobonga Madlala has been able to transform the lives of the villagers from mere subsistence farmers to viable and profitable sugarcane growers. This project has created job opportunities for the community members.
The very same members of the cooperatives are employed within the cooperative, enjoying salaries every month, and also at the end of the season enjoy the benefits of dividends in their own project. Job creation that it has brought about. In any space in 1 month, we employ over 400 people. Like the previous couple months we've been planting, we had over 600 people employed in the system.
48-year-old Joseph Ndlovu is a member of the community who benefits from the proceeds of the cooperative. He considers himself a shareholder.
Now as we come into a business, because we are shareholders.
Mansomini Cooperative has been successful because, for Madlala, strict financial policy and accountability to all members is paramount in his business.
With our sugar industry that is so well organized, we are fortunate to have in-house economists within the Sugarcane Association, where we've got our own sugarcane farmers economists who come in and help us with budgets. That's first. Secondly, in-house within our project, we've placed the right resources in place. We have an administration team that works in specifically to ensure that we stick to our budgets, and also for transparency purposes to ensure that proper records are in place. We have an office, a full-time accounting officer who actually runs our records, and that helps in the end of the season when we distribute dividends to actually account to our costs and then what our bottom lines are.
The viability of the sugarcane project has resonated among young people who had left the village to seek better paid jobs in urban cities. Many have returned home to this rural area to find employment. One of the young returnees is 30-year-old Bongani Ndlovu. Ndlovu works as the mechanical engineer for the cooperative.
As much as we would like to be in urban areas, but we have to think of our brothers and sisters that we left back. So whenever you're talking job creation, we have seen so many things happening in our local area. Eventually you decide and say, no, let me go and contribute to my own community just to get everybody a piece of bread at the end of the day.
Siobonga Madlala and members of the Mansomini Sugar Cooperative are the new breed of black farmers who are now examples to other village communities in the country.
Subri Govender reporting, and Making a Difference returns at the same time next week. It's nearly time to say goodbye, but before we leave you, a reminder of our main stories. Nigeria's military say they know the location of the hundreds of missing schoolgirls abducted by Islamist extremists from a remote village just under 2 months ago. Malawians have been expressing concern that their country's electoral crisis could impact adversely on their daily lives. And Sierra Leone has confirmed its first death from the Ebola virus. We welcome your comments on this programme. You can text us on country code 49160 957 59510. That's 49160 957 59510. Send an email to feedback.africa@dw.de or a letter to Africa Link, DW 53110. Bonn, Germany. As always, thank you for listening, and do try and join us again at the same time tomorrow. This is Mark Caldwell in Bonn.